WGBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay, and always streaming
ABC
on the
News,
Civic Media
I'm
app.
Chuck Sievertson. A sweeping 37-count federal grand jury indictment accuses former President Trump of mishandling classified documents and enlisting aides and others to help him keep from giving them back. ABC News Chief Justice Correspondent Pierre Thomas.
During his presidency, they wrote, Trump gathered classified documents and other material in boxes, including information regarding defense and weapons capabilities of both the United States and foreign countries, United States nuclear programs, potential vulnerabilities of the United States and its allies to military attack, and plans for possible retaliation in response to a foreign attack.
Security is ramped up at the federal courthouse in Miami, where Mr. Trump is scheduled to appear Tuesday. President and First Lady Jill Biden visited newly renamed Fort Liberty, North Carolina today. He signed an executive order expanding employment and economic opportunities for military families within the federal government. Former British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's quitting as a lawmaker. This is ABC News. And what did you do when you were 14?
Kyron Kwasi is not old enough to drive or see an R-rated movie in the theater on his own, but he is now the youngest graduate in the history of Santa Clara University.
I'm graduating with a degree in computer science and engineering.
Just 14 years old, Kwasi is joining SpaceX to work on its Starlink program.
I think there's a conventional mindset that I'm missing out on a childhood. But I don't think that's true.
Kwasi started college when he was 11 years old. If you ask him, he says he had a pretty normal college experience.
R. Alex Stone, the Pope's doing better, says ABC's Tom Rivers.
Pope Francis is progressively improving, says the Vatican. After another restful night, he's spending time in an armchair working and reading the papers. The 86-year-old was admitted to the Gemelli Hospital on Wednesday for his second operation in 2 years to remove intestinal scar tissue and repair a hernia.
He's supposed to be in the hospital for a few more days. Chuck Sievertson, ABC News.
The Cripescast with me, Charlie Barron, Saturdays and Sundays at noon on Civic Media and the Civic Media app.
All right, who's ready to eat? We got brats for dinner, marshmallows for dessert.
For Civic Media News, I'm Pete Schwabe. Here's what you need to know in Northeast Wisconsin. Fentanyl deaths are on the rise in Winnebago County. The sheriff's office said what makes the highly potent drugs so dangerous are counterfeit pills. Fentanyl can not only be disguised using different shapes and colors, it can easily be made to look like other less potent drugs, such as OxyContin, Vicodin, or Percocet. According to Jeremiah Winsher, project director of the Lake Winnebago Area Metropolitan Enforcement Group's drug unit, fentanyl is 100 times more potent than morphine. Authorities issued an emergency public service announcement hoping to get the word out about counterfeit pills. The Lake Winnebago Area Drug Unit has seized almost 300% more fentanyl than over the same six-month period last year. Mike Gallagher says he will not challenge incumbent Tammy Baldwin for her Senate seat. The U.S. representative for Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District will focus on being reelected to the House in 2024.
Pete Schwabe, Civic Media News.
Attention, Wisconsin veterans.
Hello, I'm Tony Evers, the governor of Wisconsin. If you are a veteran struggling to pay for rent, utilities, or other life-sustaining services, I want you to know that the Veterans Rental Assistance Program is here to help. You have already made a most noble sacrifice. You shouldn't have to continue doing so. We are here to support you. The Veterans Rental Assistance Program was created by and for people living in Wisconsin, with benefit approvals being issued to veterans in just days, not months. It's never easy to ask for assistance, but rest assured, we're here to help. You've always been there for us. We want you to know that we're here for you. Call 833-WISVRAP. That's 833-947-8727. Or visit VRAPWI.com. On behalf of the state of Wisconsin, thank you.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios.
Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
This summer, 1590 AM and 97.9 WGBW has a new starting lineup. Starting at 6 a.m., The Mayor and Mino. Then at 8, The Earl Ingram Show. 10 to 12, As Goes Wisconsin. At noon, Civic Media Network News. At 12:15, Town Call. 1 to 3, The Todd Alba Show. 3 to 4, Matt Flynn Direct. 4 to 6, The Devil's Advocates with Dom and Crude. And 6 to 7, The Maggie Dawn Show.
On 1590 AM and 97.9 WGBW.
The Todd Alba Show.
We'll be moving to the afternoon, Monday through Friday, 1 until 3. Trigvi Olsen has graciously agreed to follow us into the afternoon. We're going to get to talk about the Lincoln Project and politics in Wisconsin, all across the state of Wisconsin.
I know, isn't that exciting? Where the beer is cold, the cheese curds are squeaky, the Harleys roar, the Eagles soar, and the Packers score, Todd.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekday afternoons from 1 till 3 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Don't let biased algorithms or degree screens or exclusive professional networks or stereotypes, don't let anything keep you from discovering the half of the workforce who are stars. Workers skilled through alternative routes rather than a bachelor's degree. It's time to tear the paper ceiling and see the stars beyond it. Find out how you can make stars part of your talent strategy at tearthepaperceiling.org. Brought to you by Opportunity at Work and the Ad Council.
Hey, folks, keep her moving to Civic Media every Saturday and Sunday at noon for the Cripescast with me, Charlie Behrens.
We've been out here all day. We've had 5 or 6 beers and only one fish.
Boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, we come to you from Burlington, Iowa. This one of the places I was looking forward to on the tour. Again, most of the, all the places that we've been to, we spent a lot of time, a lot of energy, a lot of effort putting into, but this, the big strike. The Case New Holland strike has been going on for nearly 6 months now. And this is another one of those situations, another one of those moments where it's apparent from the outside. Now, look, I'm not in the intense negotiations that go on behind the scenes, but when you look at it from the outside, extraordinarily profitable corporation, long-time dedicated workforce, heroes, remember, pandemic, essential, patriotic, heroes, frontline heroes, you know, all those names, those things we attach to the people who showed up and worked through the pandemic. Seems like this could have been an easy negotiation. Seemed like this could have been something that didn't have to come to, right now, almost a six-month-long strike. And a six-month-long strike that has been fairly contentious, given the fact that this company is going, well, screw you guys, screw you people that made us all this profit. We're going to bring in scabs. Now, the thing that's interesting to me is that in talking with some of the workers here, it's amazing. And public safety has got to play into this as well, you know, because I hadn't thought of this before. These people make, you know, heavy machinery. And they're telling stories of watching the trucks come across the line and seeing the wrong parts put on machines, seeing things that aren't well quite done right, finding parts along the side of the road that, well, you just kind of fell off. You kind of got to wonder how long something like this could go on. But, you know, understand, these corporations, these giant mega corporations have deep, deep pockets. And when you get one of these CEOs and you get these folks who have bought into, hey, you know, we can bust that union. Hey, we can put those workers back in their place. This could go on for a while. And I keep talking about the shareholders, because shareholders don't care about anything other than making more money, lining their pockets, right? This is going to be long-term harmful, because if I'm a customer looking for one of these products, I am nowhere near buying one of them, especially now during this strike period where you have these scabs coming in and doing really pathetic work. When you're finding, you know, giant pieces of metal laying along the side of the road, as some of the folks have pointed out, there's a problem with your product. And this is where you go, we should want our skilled people back in here. And you know, look, the people that we're going to talk to today, folks that we've walked the picket line with, these are, you know, second, third, fourth generation people who have spent and dedicated their life to this product. And look, you know, the jobs that come out of them are extremely important. But you know, the thing that got me, and when you get into these manufacturing settings, you know, people take on that product as part of their identity, their pride. You know, they build this quality product that goes out into the community and does this important work. And here, you know, part of that is, You know, they make machinery for the agricultural industry. You know, they feed not just America, but the world. And to have a product go out, one of these big machines go out into the world that isn't right, you know, they take and I had a couple of people tell me this. It's a reflection on them, not just this big corporation. And this is one of those moments where corporate America, I think, is losing people. You know, workers want to identify with what they do. They want to identify with the products that they make and the pride and the passion that they put into it. Yes, it's about the paycheck. Yes, it's about the health care. It's about the pensions. It's about all of those things. It's about being able to provide a lifestyle for your family and yourselves. Yeah, all of that is an absolute, but also the sense that you're doing something that matters. And grabbing on to the pride of that product, or that, you know, I did that. You know, that comes out in this. And, you know, as I was talking to people on the picket line, and as we're going to talk to folks today here on the program, that sense that their product is being harmed, that the things that they put their name on is being harmed. And maybe it's hard to grasp, but or maybe it's really just simple. People take pride in what they do. And to have a giant conglomerate like this, and look, this is a big company. They don't care about the average everyday worker. I know they've all got open door policies. They care. Big signs that say how much they care, how important the workers are, and thank you for your hard, dedicated service. Platitudes. Because when it comes down to it, if they really cared about their workforce, they would care that they were making wages that they could support the families and not have to take on a second job. They would care about their workers and make sure that they had health security and retirement security. That's not necessarily the case here. And these workers coming out of the pandemic, as a lot of workers right now are in the process of doing, have said, you know what? We've had enough. Now, again, I come back to, as an outside observer, from what I've been told was offered by the company, there was no way that the workers could take it. There's no way that this could be a concessionary contract during a massive profit era could be at all tolerated. And there's part of me that goes, like a lot of these things, it's not about the job, it's not about the income, it's not about the wages, it's not about the benefits, it's not about any of that. It's about the fact that these workers have a voice on the job. These workers demand a say, and that's what the company hates. Quick break, right back.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1926. That was the day that one of the great labor leaders in U.S. history, Eugene V. Debs, died in Elmhurst, Illinois. In 1894, Debs gained national attention when his American Railway Union launched a boycott in support of the striking workers of the Pullman Palace Car Company. The strike and the boycott were crushed by federal troops and a federal court. Debs served 6 months in jail for his role in the boycott. Later, Debs would again go to jail for standing up for his beliefs. He was convicted for speaking out against U.S. involvement in World War I. He was among the founders of the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, in 1905. He ran as a socialist for President of the United States 5 times, receiving nearly 1 million votes running his campaign from a prison cell in 1920. In 1891, Debs wrote an article for the Locomotive Fireman's Magazine titled The Unity of Labor. His words stand as an eloquent case for worker solidarity. Debs wrote, quote, "If working men were united in sympathetic bonds, if a bricklayer could comprehend the fact that he is dependent on the hod carrier, if the locomotive engineer could grasp the fact that he is dependent on the locomotive fireman, the interdependence of labor would at once constitute a bond of union, a chain whose link, forged and fashioned to hold working men in harmonious alliance, would girt them with a defense in every time of trouble and resist invasion, though assailed by all the plutocrats that ever cursed the earth." Debs spent his life trying to bring about this harmonious alliance of working people and standing up for the causes of peace, and justice. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So we've made our way to Burlington, Iowa, and we're sitting here in the UAW hall. And it's one of these moments, you know, on this tour, the Working Class Heroes Radio Tour, one of the things we've been focusing on is, you know, how do we make sure that we rebuild that American dream? How do we give workers the chance to lead the lives that our grandparents' generation fought, bled, and died for? The eight-hour day, overtime, reasonable wages at work, safe working conditions. And, I don't know. Remember that call, 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, 8 hours for what we will? Maybe reviving the idea of the eight-hour day. When we're here in Burlington talking about the workers who have been on strike for, I guess it's been almost 6 months now at the Case New Holland factory. And I'm sitting here with Michael Banks. Michael's an assembly worker here at Case New Holland. Michael, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you. Thanks for coming down.
No, appreciate you taking a little time for us. This is a tough time. Nobody, and I've been on strike in my life over the course of my working life, nobody wants this, do they?
Nobody. Not one of us wanted to walk out when we did, but in solidarity, we all did together, like what you were talking about, so we can provide a better future for our families. Never would have thought it would have lasted this long, but here we are, almost 6 months, and we're still working that picket line every single day.
Now, you said something before we went on air that caught my attention. You know, I said, so you like what you do, and your immediate response was no.
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 No, I don't know if anybody really likes factory work. It's what you do to make money and put food on the table for your family. I worked in broadcasting for 20 years, loved it, was passionate about it. But you have children, you have needs, and you live in a factory town. You decide to go work for a factory. That's what I did. And it was fine. I mean, you go to work, you leave work at work. Your phone's not ringing at 2 or 3 in the morning for this, that, and the other. Can leave work at work, make an honest paycheck. Everything was fine until all of a sudden this strike happened.
And why did this strike happen? You know, we were just up in Cedar Rapids. The Ingredion workers there have been on strike for 76 days, 77 days now. And they keep talking about standard of living. They keep talking about work-life balance. It's not even really about wages as much as it is about I would like a day off or occasionally.
Yeah, well, all those things that you talk about. I mean, I know that my parents' generation, my grandparents' generation, certain things that came with working for especially a major corporation, something like a pension. I don't think my generation, unless you work for a government or something, you even know what a pension is. Just to be able to provide a secure future for your family, I don't think that that's too much to ask for. Apparently, with the company that we work for, it is. We're not asking to be rich. We're not asking for anything more than just cost of living. You've all seen it. We've all seen it. The price of living, cost of living's gone way up. It's not Case's fault. It's not our fault. But are they charging more for their products? I'm guessing they probably are, and yet they don't want to pay more to build those products. And it's no coincidence that the one of the most productive factories they have, I believe us and our brothers and sisters up in Racine, Wisconsin, are the most productive plants that they have. I don't think it's a coincidence that those are both the union plants, the only two union plants that are left for Case New Holland.
So the question then becomes, is this more about breaking the union, as I believe it is up at Ingredion, than it is about sitting down and actually hammering out a decent agreement?
Well, I'm not a union officer. I'm not in those negotiations. I don't really see much of what's going on behind the scenes, but I think it is. Why companies want to break unions, I think, is simply for the reason that they corporate greed. And that's the crux of what we're at here. Corporate, I'm not an economist or anything, but I'm guessing if you look at the numbers, corporate profits are an all-time high and workers' benefits are probably near all-time low. A middle ground, I think, is not only just but fair, and that's part of the reason, the overall reason why we're out.
No, again, I come back to you, something you said a moment ago about this not being your passion. This is how you support your family. And we talk about this all the time. We give up hours of our lives for the wages that we earn so that we can live to work or work to live. Our job is how we pay for our homes, our children, our food, all that stuff. It's not who and what we are. But, you know, I look at these corporations and you point out the corporate greed. They have not been more profitable in my lifetime than they are right now. At Case New Holland, extraordinarily profitable. So for me as an outsider looking in, which is why I asked you the question, it seems like the only reasonable, logical explanation for pushing this is, well, they want more wealth, they want more power, and they want to get the voice of workers diminished.
Yeah, I thought it was, you know, we all went through this pandemic, and it was everybody fought it differently. In many ways, we're still kind of going through it, especially the after effects thereof. We were labeled essential. A couple weeks after March, whatever it was, in 2020 that this pandemic broke up and everybody was supposed to be home to be safe for their families, we were told to go to work. We were essential because if we don't work, and the part of the plant that I work at makes the heads for combines, if we don't work, people can't eat. We can't get crops out of fields, which for the global population is very, very important. So we were labeled as essential workers. Well, apparently not, because if we were essential, we'd be back there working today.
No, and again, I've talked to so many working people over the last several months who internalized that, that they were essential, they were frontline heroes, the right. Patriotism of going through a dangerous period to make sure, as you point out, that people are going to be able to eat. And I think workers internalized that. Everybody I talked to, they took pride in the fact that they were willing to take on the risk and sacrifice not just themselves but their families to ensure that the rest of us do well. That's kind of been totally ripped away from us. And now it's back to, hey, we want to go back to the way things were pre-pandemic, which is just be happy you have a job.
Yeah. We don't have a job right now, so we're not even happy with that. But again, we all knew this was coming. The contract was up at a certain date. We all saw it coming. We all knew it was coming. And then the inflation hit, coronavirus and all that thing. So it's not a surprise, I think, to Case that we would be asking for a little bit more than what we had before, because most companies are giving their employees what they need to survive and keep themselves happy. I mean, don't they want a workforce?
No, and what they earn. Look, you guys earn every penny that you get. And this is where I think a lot of people get into this. No, we deserve this. No, you earned this.
Right.
You create the wealth that this company benefits from. The shareholders do very well. The CEO, I'm sure, does. I'm sure your CEO is not struggling in this moment.
No, he might be struggling to decide which Ferrari he wants to put in his garage next or something like that. But no, we're just trying to earn an honest living, make money for the company. It's surprising, before we went out, we knew that at May 2nd or May 1st, the end of April, our contract was going to be up. Yet leading up to that, we would see our company bragging about the profits that they would make. We made $9 billion last quarter. We made so many billion dollars the last quarter. It's like, that's great, but we're the ones making that money for you. Yep. Our supervisors have no clue as to how to put these products together. It's that tribal knowledge that's been handed down from brothers from one generation to the next. I mean, Case has been around for a very long time. I'm talking about specifically the company here in Burlington, Iowa. And to make those backhoes, have been making him since the 1800s. And that tribal knowledge passed from one generation to the other. You can't put a price on that.
No, you're absolutely right. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Michael Binks. Michael's an assembly worker here at Case New Holland. They've been on strike almost 6 months.
Yeah, 5.5 months.
Which, again, is one of these things. Nobody wants to be on strike. Nobody wants to be in this situation. I'm sure this is a struggle on your family. I know the CEO is not struggling, but I'm sure you and your family are.
Yeah, the strike pay helps a little bit, but it's not enough. It's about a third of what I would make. And I'm not talking about dental, vision, a 401k matching money. They're all the benefits that go with that, paid vacation. In order for me to be comfortable now, and most of us that are on the strike line are, we have side hustles. For example, I'm doing Walmart grocery delivery. All right. People do DoorDash. People are doing little extra things here just to try to make ends meet when we shouldn't have to be doing that. Those who aren't are struggling and just want to get back to work.
Yeah, and again, I come back to this, and I talked about it with the workers at Ingredion. The fact that you and your coworkers aren't there building the best product possible, because as you talked about, this institutional knowledge that's there to create this product that's making billions of dollars in profit, you're now getting subpar workmanship, because I'm assuming the supervisors are still trying to tinker around and put things together, right?
Yeah, from what I've heard on the inside, a lot of the dealers won't even accept the products.
Why would you? I mean, if you're buying something, do you want the second team to come in and put your thing together?
Right.
And then you're, because the products you guys sell,
really expensive stuff.
Yeah.
So if you get something that's done in a, well, halfway fashion, you know that's going to be problems going forward. And this is harmful for the brand. So this is where I keep coming back to, why would a company force this unless they had a long-term idea of, we're just going to break the union and we're going to silence workers and their voices?
At first, I thought maybe because of the supply chain issues that they didn't even have the steel for us to go back to work at all, which I would understand, you know, and they're just, oh, let them sit out until we get the steel and we get our global supply issues figured out and then we'll have them back. I never would have thought that would have taken 6 months, and now I definitely don't think that that's the case. I think this is about pride. It's about we're right and you're not, and I don't know. I mean, I don't understand. We make them so much more money. At their bottom line, it would be better for them to bring us back and pay us average cost of living, because their profits would be exponentially more than they are today.
Yeah. No, it's incredible. And we go through this in all of these strike scenarios, Mike. Whether it's nurses, whether it's factory workers, no matter who it is, we see that these companies are willing to spend unlimited amounts of money to fix the mistakes that they've made by forcing their workers to go on strike. I look at the nurses up in Massachusetts. The company spent $10 million, which was like five times as much as those nurses were asking for in the entire life of their contract. Same thing with the Ingredion guys. They're spending, you know, tens of thousands, if not millions of dollars to try and break the strike when they could have just given the workers what they wanted and saved money. That's the part that I struggle with.
Yeah, well, I think we all struggle with it. And again, when John Deere went on strike back earlier this spring, I believe it was, they were on strike for 3 or 4 weeks, because I think maybe their corporate culture got it. I'm not sure what's going on with Case. I hope that they get it. I hope they realize we want to go back to work. We want to make them that money. We want to get back there and make the best product that we possibly can, you know, better every single day. But we can only do so much. We're not just going to go back for nothing. We're not going to go back and work 12-hour days straight in a row. There's got to be a work balance, a life balance. And I think that's better for their product anyway. If you've got a happy workforce and a well-paid workforce, that's got to be better for the product at the end of the day as well.
Yeah, because you get people who stay. I mean, I think part of the problem is, and I worked for a union company years ago who used to tout the fact that they had a 1% turnover rate, that the people who worked for the company were there long-term, dedicated to the company, best product, best quality, all of this stuff, much like you're saying. And it was because of the union. It was because of the wage. Look, as you pointed out earlier, nobody wants to work in a factory. What they want is they want the lifestyle that it affords them. It's the wages. It's the benefits. It's the opportunities that come because of that job, not because of what you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think anybody – I mean, my daughter is almost 10. If you ask her or any of her friends, what do you want to be when you grow up? I doubt any of them are going to say, I want to work in a factory.
Yeah.
It's just the real world hits at some point in your life, and you say, look, I'm going to roll up my sleeves, go to work. And I'm going to make a quality product. I'm going to be proud of what I make, but I'm also going to be proud of what I provide for my family.
Yeah. So let me ask you a last line of questioning, because, you know, community support is so important in all of these things. As someone who's been on strike in the past, I know that is a big part of what kind of support are you getting from the community, and how's that affecting folks on the line?
Especially in the beginning, we got major support. Of course, it's waned after 6 months. I think a lot of people, when I, you know, see friends out and about, oh, you're still on strike? You guys are still on strike? I think people are surprised that we've been out this long, that it's lasted this long. But the community does still support us. You see signs all over town. We support our union workers. We're a proud union family. We support the CNH workers on strike. They still, donations come in, not like they used to, for, you know, bottles of water. Guys that are down there when it was 100 degrees, you know, and ice and water, people would bring pizzas by, things like that. But the support probably has waned a little bit, but that's to be expected, as we've been out for half a year almost.
Yeah. What's the message to the company and the CEO here? What's the message to him?
Message from me to him is, hey, we're ready to get back to work. What's the holdup here? The holidays are coming up. I know that the first quarter next year is coming up. We all just want to get back. It's going to be weird when we do go back. It's going to be awkward. We want to get past that. We want to get these replacement workers that have been in Burlington the last 6 months. I know the community hasn't been too happy with them. We want to get them out of here and get us back in.
We don't call them scabs anymore.
We call them scabs.
Yeah. Okay, I just wanted to make sure we were still on the same page, because, you know, that whole replacement worker thing sounds nice and soft. They're scabs.
They're scabs. They are ones who are willing to go in and take my job, and then I've even noticed some of them taking my side job. You know, doing the delivery, the grocery delivery. I'm like, wait a second, you're taking my main job and my side job too? We're ready to get Burlington back to Burlington, case back to case, and we can all be happily ever after.
There you go. Mike, I appreciate the time. Thanks
so much.
Thank
you, Rick. Appreciate it.
Good stuff. Mike Banks, assembly worker here at Case New Holland. I want to hear your thoughts. You can email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Tell us what you think. Back after this. Stick around.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1912. That was the day mill workers began to walk off the job at the Phoenix and Gilbert Knitting Mills in Little Falls, New York. The strike was sandwiched between the Bread and Roses strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts, and the 1913 Patterson Textile Strike. American, Hungarian, Polish, and Italian workers, over 70% of them women, struck against wage reductions. Their hours had just been cut from 60 hours a week to 54, and their wages adjusted accordingly. A recent Factory Inspection Commission investigation revealed deplorable working and living conditions, among the worst in the state. As a result, state legislators passed protective legislation restricting women's work hours. Many social reformers pushed for laws like these in the hopes of improving women's quality of life by minimizing their exploitation on the job. But the reduction in hours spelled disaster for these mill women, who then faced a loss of income that ranged between 75 cents and $2 a week. Socialists in nearby Schenectady, including the socialist mayor George Lund, arrived in town and were promptly arrested for giving open-air speeches in support of the strikers. IWW organizers soon followed to help organize picketing, daily strike parades, and strike committees for each of the factories. They quickly established IWW Local 801, the National Industrial Union of Textile Workers. By the end of the month, mounted police closed in on the women strikers and began clubbing them, many into unconsciousness. The police raided strike headquarters and arrested IWW strike committee leaders. But the women strikers stood strong and were celebrating victory by the end of the year. They won full reinstatement and 60 hours pay for 54 hours work.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Throughout the country, newspaper subscribers are asking questions like, hey, who took my Saturday paper? What happened to those political cartoons and columns that I liked? Why does it take 2 days to get election results and sports scores? How did my local paper get filled with filler? Oh, and who doubled the price of the damn thing? The cause of all the above is a Wall Street concept called financialization, a euphemism for corporate plundering. Multibillion-dollar hedge funds like SoftBank Group, Alden Capital, and Chatham Asset have bought up thousands of our dailies and weeklies. They extract enormous profits not by making a better journalistic product for customers and the community, but by eliminating reporters, selling off each paper's real estate and assets, shriveling and standardizing content, and jacking up the paper's price. Like avaricious airlines, the profit strategy of these Wall Street newspapers is to monopolize the market, then charge more for less. But won't readers stop subscribing? Of course, they're leaving in droves. But hedge fund profiteers don't care, for their plan is to strip mine the business of every dime it has, take the profits, and leave town. For example, SoftBank, the Japanese owner of the Gannett chain, has pillaged hundreds of our local papers and is now making another round of deep cuts in its newsrooms, including dumping some 800 more journalists. The financializers are also requiring other employees to take unpaid leave and are suspending payments to their pensions. SoftBank bosses simply said, "We need to ensure our balance sheet remains strong." This is Jim Hightower saying, sure, take care of number one, but what about ensuring that local journalism remains strong, providing the information and connections that communities must have for strong democracies? But don't be silly, that's not part of the hedge fund business model.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Working Class Heroes Radio Tour, brought to you by the good folks at American Family Voices and our friends over at Courier Newsroom. You can check out where we've been, where we're going. Just go to thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program's podcast, wherever you get your favorite podcasts, you'll find ours. We're sitting here in Burlington, Iowa at UAW 807, their local union hall, and I'm sitting there here with their president. Nick Guernsey is the president here. Nick, thanks for taking some time for us.
Hey, thanks for coming down. You know, it's anytime we can get the word out, we got to get the word out.
I appreciate it. You guys have been really extraordinarily hospitable. Thank you for opening up your hall to us. A great place. And when we walk into the, we drove in, and there's such an amazing picture that we're going to put up on social media. You got the giant tower behind with, you know, Burlington on. You got the American flag, the UAW logo out front. Just a picture of, I guess, of America and of Iowa, really.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's the greatest state, and you know, for us anyway. But you know, some people have different opinions on that. But for myself, you know, to be a proud union member with everything, you got to have what you got to have, and in order to have that, we got some pretty good picturesque backgrounds. No,
really, very, very nice picture. But you know, as we were driving here through Burlington, one of the things that caught my attention that we don't see in every community, and haven't been seeing as much as I would like to see, is you guys are handing out signs that, you know, say, look, proud union home. Mm-hmm. People out in front of their homes are saying, look, this is who we are. This is it, that we're proud of who we are. I love that.
Yeah, you know, and community support in a strike environment is what you got to have, right? Because we're not just on strike for our needs. We're on strike for our community. You know, if we can reap the benefits, the community reaps the benefits. You know, we're community-based. We live in the community. We work in the community. You know, our kids go to school in the community. It doesn't just affect my members. It affects everybody in the community.
Well, it's an excellent point. And, you know, nobody wants a strike. And we've been talking about this all show, that nobody wants this. You know, I've never met anyone who said, boy, I can't wait to go on strike and not have a job and not have health care and any of that stuff. But sometimes you're pushed into it. And I look at this situation at Case New Holland. You guys have been on strike for almost 6 months now. This is a corporation, and again, I'm going to hammer on this because it's true, wildly profitable, and yet not really willing to share. I mean, this is sandbox stuff. You guys make them an enormous amount of profit. This is where you should be sharing in the fruits of your labor.
You know, and I'm going to go a step farther back. During the pandemic, you know, we were essential infrastructure workers. You know, guys, the company broke every rule they could break to keep us working. And the response to us was, hey, we're going to make it right. Contract's coming up. We're going to make it right. We're going to make it right. And day one of contract negotiations, it was the farthest thing from that. And here we are going on week 24, and we're still not there. And again, you know, nobody wins in a strike, but to say we were forced into a corner, we were definitely forced into a corner with a company that didn't want to take any of our demands seriously and really didn't want to take us seriously for that fact.
Yeah, you know, I look at this, and I said it earlier in the program, you know, the reality is if I'm a shareholder, I'm looking at this as corporate malpractice. This is a company that was making an incredible product, wildly profitable, and now if I'm a consumer, I'm not looking at Case New Holland as someone to buy anything from right now. Because I got to assume whatever's coming out of that factory done by scab workers or whoever they can throw into those positions, not going to be the quality product that you expect.
That's 100% true, if they are building anything at all. You hear the horror stories. We've got people inside the plant that don't want to be in there. I call them, you know, sympathizers from inside the Kremlin, as would be. They don't want to be in that plant working, but they have to. They're sympathetic to our cause, so they're feeding us information. We know what's going on. And yeah, to go even a little deeper, we know the company has used stockholder buybacks to mirror the effect of this strike for their shareholders. I said in the beginning of the strike that the strike ends when the shareholders lose a dollar amount. You know, and if they can keep masking that, which is they can get away with it for a while, but the bottom line is, there's no product being built. We're not just affecting the Burlington plant. It's not just affecting the Racine plant. You know, it's affecting other non-union plants because of the products that we make. You know, you can only do that for so long. You can only put a mask on something for so long before the true problem comes out.
Yeah, there can only be so much lipstick on this pig and before it wears off. And the hope is that they come around to their senses because, look, as I said, nobody wants to be on strike, but sometimes you're pushed into this and sometimes you're at the end of the road and this is how this – now, did you expect this, you know, coming into this moment? Because, you know, as you said, you know, they were telling you during – we're going to make it up to you. You're keeping us afloat during the pandemic. You're doing yeoman's work, patriotic, essential, frontline hero, all that garbage. Were you expecting this?
I'm going to say February, no. When we sat down for local negotiations, after the first week of local – I came and we had a e-board meeting and some of the other committee met and I said, we are probably 95% looking at a strike right now. The company doesn't want to deal with this. They just, there's take it or leave it attitude. And, you know, with everything going on in the world, just not the right time. Now maybe if it was say pre-COVID, this contract, what they've offered up so far, might have been an okay one. Still would have been met with some resistance from some of our senior members, but for the most part, probably could have been tolerable. Now it's not. Post-COVID world has changed everything.
Yeah, no, and I hear that a lot. I hear that an awful lot. So let me ask you this, Nick, because we've got listeners out there who have never been in a union. They don't know how this works. They're used to the company tells them what they're going to get. The company gets to impose whatever conditions, whatever wages. It's most certainly a master-servant relationship for the vast majority of workers, and they're not understanding why you're pushing back. Why do we do that?
The reason we push back is to not only better our lives, but better the next generation coming up. The beauty thing about a union is it's one person, one vote. You know, you have a say. As a union member, if you're not happy with something, you have a say. There's a little bit more to where you can attack a company. I don't want to say maybe attack's not the right word, but where you can challenge a company to do better on a safety aspect, a wage aspect, working hours.
It always comes back to wages, hours, and conditions, doesn't it?
Yeah, you know, and you know, we've seen it throughout the course of history where a strike has happened because of safety concerns, or a strike has happened because they're paying them, you know, pennies on the dollar.
What happened to the labor call of 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, 8 hours for what we will?
Yeah.
What happened to that? Because I'm talking to people, not just here, but, you know, in other places across the country where they're being forced to work 10, 12, 14-hour days, you know, weeks at a time without a day off. You know, this is the kind of stuff that we're seeing being played out in the where the battleground really is.
And when you talk to the companies about that, it'll be we just need flexibility, guys. It's flexibility. Flexibility, in my mind, is because you don't know how to manage your business.
Amen.
I mean,
amen. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Nick Kersey. He's the president of UAW Local 807 here in Burlington, Iowa, the folks who represent the striking workers at Case New Holland. If you want to check out our website, thericksmithshow.com, find out where we've been, where we're going here on the Working Class Heroes Radio Tour. I do want to... I've been on strike in the past. I know what the struggles are. They're kind of universal. You know, the first day companies cut off health insurance and the way the paycheck stops. There's lots of hardship that goes into these victories that are hopefully eventually won down the road. But, you know, in these moments, there's still families who are struggling. And I'm curious, and I'm sure that there are folks here in your local that are having a hard time.
Yeah, so the company killed our health insurance week two, you know, and gave us some big spiel how the union and the company had discussed the path forward. We never discussed that. The company did that. The UAW stepped up and, you know, covered our health insurance, just major medical from there. But yeah, I got members that are fighting cancer, that are not looking good, that, you know, the company by doing this, and it's crazy thing here is I've had HR call me here in my office and, you know, give me the right act about, you know, how can you guys do this? Why aren't these, hey, you guys killed our health insurance. If you would have been civil about this, this member wouldn't have had to wait the time it took to get him through the process. We've had a member unfortunately passed away very early in the strike. He had to have open heart surgery. And a week later passed away. The company didn't pay out his life insurance. And when I sent the email and I, you know, I said, hey, what's going on? You know, yada, yada, yada. You're not working. You have no insurance. Well, life insurance is a benefit. We're still employed by this company.
Right.
You know, we didn't quit. You know, we're just in a labor dispute. And for them not to do that, and then we just had a couple scab workers get killed up in Racine County last week, and for the company to put out a statement about, you know, they're deeply saddened by this, I didn't get that from my member who'd been with the company for 15-plus years. So, yeah, some companies are good to work for, and unfortunately CNH is not one of them.
Well, it comes down to the bottom line, doesn't it? I mean, this is the sad reality in this moment, which, again, is why I say workers need to be organizing and coming together, because these companies, they don't really care about you. You're just a number most of the time, which is why, you know, being part of something like a union is so important.
Yeah, and, you know, the biggest part is we're only as strong as our weakest member. So, we got to stick together, right? That's the whole point, power in numbers. You know, if 400 of us stick together, we're strong. You know, but if you can't all stick together on the issues, you run into issues. And we are here to make the next generation better. If we can reap the benefits of it during my working career, great. But I'm here to make the next generation better and make my community better for it.
So let's get back to the strike. What ends this? I know, you know, the company comes back to the table, but what ends this? What gets your guys back to work and your women back to work, so that you can make the quality product that you're making, make the shareholders happy because you're making them profits? How do we end this insanity?
Well, we're still stuck. Wages, we're maybe a little closer than what we were. Expectation-wise, we're way far off. But insurance. You know, that is probably the biggest key right now. And we want time off. We want to go back to that eight-hour structure to where we're not living in these plants. You know, my membership typically works a 12-hour day, 4 days a week, and then mandatory Friday. You know, yeah, we might get Saturday, Sunday off, but they're begging us to come in and work. Now,
why is that? Again, I've been hearing this time and time again. You know, these are good jobs. These are jobs that do have benefits, that have some retirement stuff. You know, why are they having such a hard time getting and keeping people? It's the same thing when we were up the road at Ingredion. They just can't keep people. What's the cause behind that, do you think?
Toxic management.
And the fact is, as you point out, you know, the reality is nobody wants to go to work and have to work, you know, 12 hours a day, you know, 5-6 days a week, mandatory. This is the part that gets me. Look, there's the overtime that's voluntary, and mm-hmm. You know, fortunately, I've been in places where they go, hey, we want you to work. They encourage it, and people who want to work the overtime, God bless you, you knock yourself out. But most people, I think, just want to go and do their time and support their families.
You know, and the way the world's changed. You know, back 20, 30 years ago, one member of the household, you know, was the breadwinner. Well, now we got mothers and fathers working out of the same household, some of them working in my plant together. You got, you know, your kids are in sports. Traveling sports is huge around here. You know, so the membership wants to be able to go enjoy their family. You know, that's why you go to work, is to provide for your family. And, you know, corporations nowadays, especially CNH, think that, you know, you come to work for us, we own you, and that's not the case. You know, we've got lives outside of work, and, you know.
Yeah, back to the old question, do you work to live or live to work?
Exactly.
And hopefully that question gets answered. I wish you guys the best. What's the message to the CEO in this moment?
You know, you didn't need to pick this fight. You know, we could have worked this out. A strike didn't need to happen for you to try and crush us, and right now we're 24 weeks in, and who's winning?
Yeah, so to add on to that, you know, and I've asked this before, has this been forced because they want to bust the union, or is this forced because they want rules changes or things that you could argue about, or is this really about union busting?
This is 100% about union busting. You know, we two locals out of a 39 plant, you know, chain. It's 100% union busting. They didn't need to pick this fight. We've got a fairly new CEO. If you look at his track record through the last 10 years of what he's done, what he's doing now, there's a lot of smoke and mirrors here. I mean, you can get away with that with smaller companies. CNH being a big global company, I don't know how long they're going to put up with it. You know, shareholders are going to run the show. And once they realize that they're truly losing the money, then things will change.
Well, let's hope they understand that sooner as opposed to later. But, Nick, I appreciate you taking some time for us. I wish you the best. If there's anything we can do to help, by all means, reach out to us. And thank you again for inviting us into your hall.
All right. Thank you.
Nick Guernsey, he is the president here at Local 807 UAW. I'm going to take a quick break, but when we come back, I got more to get to on this topic right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Throughout the country, newspaper subscribers are asking questions like, hey, who took my Saturday paper? What happened to those political cartoons and columns that I liked? Why does it take 2 days to get election results and sports scores? How did my local paper get filled with filler? Oh, and who doubled the price of the damn thing? The cause of all the above is a Wall Street concept called financialization, a euphemism for corporate plundering. Multi-billion dollar hedge funds like SoftBank Group, Alden Capital, and Chatham Asset have bought up thousands of our dailies and weeklies. They extract enormous profits not by making a better journalistic product for customers and the community, but by eliminating reporters, selling off each paper's real estate and assets, shriveling and standardizing content, and jacking up the paper's price. Like avaricious airlines, the profit strategy of these Wall Street newspapers is to monopolize the market, then charge more for less. But won't readers stop subscribing? Of course, they're leaving in droves. But hedge fund profiteers don't care, for their plan is to strip mine the business of every dime it has, take the profits, and leave town. For example, SoftBank, the Japanese owner of the Gannett chain, has pillaged hundreds of our local papers and is now making another round of deep cuts in its newsrooms, including dumping some 800 more journalists. The financializers are also requiring other employees to take unpaid leave and are suspending payments to their pensions. SoftBank bosses simply said, "We need to ensure our balance sheet remains strong." This is Jim Hightower saying, sure, take care of number one, but what about ensuring that local journalism remains strong, providing the information and connections that communities must have for strong democracies? But don't be silly, that's not part of the hedge fund business model.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So here's the interesting part about this strike. And look, we walked the picket lines, and I'll tell you, it was cold. It was cold. It was frigid. You know, but the spirits of the folks were really high. I mean, we were there. You never come empty-handed to a picket line. We bought the folks pizzas, and you know, just it was an opportunity to meet, to talk, to share stories, and everyone was willing and really gracious and sharing their stories and their experience in this. And it came back to, you know, the more we talk to folks, the more politically people all over the map, again, this idea of a microcosm of America. You had people of all thought processes, male, female, black, white. You had all of this kind of thought process there. And yet in this moment, they were all united in the idea that, look, you know, workers should have a say at work. Seems pretty simple and universal. I think at least I hope that everybody believes that. I hope that everyone thinks that, you know, hey, you should have a say in what you do with a third of your life. You should have an opportunity to have input. You should be able to fight for better wages, hours, and of course, conditions. You should have a say in what your life-work balance is going to be. And that's a big part of this as well. You know, the forced overtime, the kind of dedication of one's life that has to be put into this. And it kept coming back to, you know, our political leaders. You know, Iowa is a no rights at work state. That's the reality. The fact that you have in this moment where the odds are overwhelmingly against these working people, that they're willing to stand up and demand better. You know, the word deserve came up a couple of times. We deserve better treatment. We deserve better wages because we work hard. And I'm like, no, I guess it's just a personal pet peeve, but you don't deserve it. You earned it. Not entitled, you earned it. It's something you should be demanding, and it's something we as a society should be demanding for all working people. You show up, you work hard, you play by the rules, you should get ahead. And I say this for every political administration. My hope is always that they figure out how to return reward to work, how they return dignity to work. You know, for a while we've been going through, we'd gone through, you know, some, you know, oh, you're just that lowly worker. Coming out of the pandemic, working people internalized this, you know, we are essential. We are important. What we did during the pandemic was patriotic, especially these folks who make agricultural machines that fed the world. They're now saying, look, we demand better. We've earned it. And I keep coming back to that because I think it's important. Now, what I hope is the courage that these workers are showing. Our political leaders find some of that courage. Because the reality is we ran into a gentleman. I said I wouldn't give out his name because he doesn't want the story to be about him. He wants the story to be about the bravery of those workers who are marching that picket line, who are manning that picket line, and who are standing up to this behemoth, wildly profitable behemoth corporation thanks to their labor. Understand, this plant, one of the top in the system, lowest attendance, lowest absentee rates, highest quality, you name all the positives that corporate America should want, this is this place, yet they're the ones who are in this moment are being abused. And why? Because they have the audacity to say that they want to be unionized and they want to have a contract and they want to actually bargain collectively with their employer. Heaven forbid. But this one gentleman refused to cross the picket line. And I've said it before, I will never cross a picket line. No one should ever scab on another person's job, ever. There's no excuse for it. And this person internalized this. He said, I'm not crossing the picket line. These people are my friends. These people are people I work with. These people are folks that, you know, I've laughed and cried with. We've gone to events together. We've, you know, welcomed babies and funerals. And they're part of who we are part of who we are. I'm not going to cross their picket line. Now, he isn't protected by a union. He doesn't have the protection. So when he said, I'm not crossing that picket line, they fired him. Yeah, because in this country, if you refuse to cross a picket line, if you refuse to scab on someone else's job, corporate America will fire you and our government says that's okay. And this is where I'm calling out to my Democratic leader friends. It's time to push for some legislation to protect people who refuse to cross a picket line. It's time to step up, be the Democratic Party, be the party of working people, and protect people of conscience. People who say, no, I'm not going to get involved in this. No, I'm not going to help break a strike by allowing you to continue to operate and put out a shoddy product. No, I'm not going to stab my neighbor in the back. No. And look, this person understood, look, I'm going to lose my job. I'm going to have a black mark on my record. I'll probably have a hard time finding another job. But in all conscience, can't do it. And he goes down to that picket line 2-3 times a week and walks with his friends, with his former coworkers. Because understand, once this is over, and he knows this, and this is where, you know, I got to tell you, I give this guy just worlds of credit because you don't find people like this anymore in this country. He said, look, once this strike is over, and it will be over, they're all going to go back to work. I'm going to be the one that doesn't have a job. But I'm doing the right thing. I'm doing the right thing in the right moment. And I can look myself in the mirror. This is where I'm calling on my Democratic friends. There has to be federal protection for workers who refuse to cross the picket line. If you're going to do nothing else, this should be a no-brainer. Most union contracts have language that workers don't cross people's picket lines, and that will protect them. You do that in the workplace. Union members protecting other union members' jobs. It's in the language of most contracts. I know it's in the contract that I work under. But this is one of those moments. Democrats, time to step up. So again, I reiterate, it's time. This is another one of those pieces of legislation that can really be helpful. We need the PRO Act, absolutely. We need to make it so that workers can join and form unions and stand together. But we also need the other part of this. And this is where I think this is so important. We need strike replacement. We need card check. We need easier for workers to grab their rights. But we also need to make it so that our friends in the community, they're not punished, that they're able to stand up with us shoulder to shoulder, that the community is able to be partners in this. Because understand, these jobs, these good union wage jobs, these are good for the community. The income that these workers make flows into the community, props up small businesses. This is why, again, I'm calling out to my Democratic friends. Now is the time to do the right thing. Now is the time to step up and pass decent legislation to protect anyone who refuses to cross a picket line.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay. WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay. And always streaming on the Civic
ABC
Media
News.
App.